the period in which we are now, we colloquially call Sfira, period we count Sfira Se'omer, is discussed in this coming week's Parsha, Parsha's Emor. The Torah actually goes through the sequence from Pesach through Sfira Se'omer to Shavuos. It's all discussed in Parsha's Emor. The Torah says that Elam Ad Hashem Mikrai Kodesh, it begins with Pesach, on the 14th of Nisan, the 15th of Nisan, we have Pesach, Chag HaMatzah, Shivas Yom HaMatzahs Tochelu, we don't work, and so on, we bring the Musafim. Then the Torah describes what we do on the second day of Pesach, when we have the temple service, we have what we call the Karban HaOmer. It says, when you enter Eretz Yisrael, you bring a Karban called it's Omer Reishis K'tirchem El HaKoin. Omer is maybe a slightly exotic word, it actually is pretty prosaic, it means Omer is a measurement, Rashi explains. Rashi says that Omer is a Sirus Eifa. Torah says in the context of the Mon, Eifa was a larger measure of volume. Omer is a tenth of an Eifa. We call Sfiras Omer, the carbon Omer, just like saying the carbon of the quart or the carbon of the gallon. But so the Omer was the measurement of how much flour, how much grain went into this carbon. It was a special carbon brought on the second day of Pesach, that you bring this carbon, you also bring animals that go along with it, and so on. Then the Torah says you count Sfira, Usfartem Lachem Imachras HaShabbos, the famous commandment to count Sfira. You count Sheva Shabbos of Tmimos, 7 times 7, 7 weeks of 7, until you get to the end, Chamishim Yom, 50 days, 49 days, and then you bring the carbon called Shtei Lechem on Shavuos, and that's actually when Shavuos is established. Shavuos is unique in that it's not fixed in terms of a day of the month. Biblically, it's 50 days after the Omer. Today the calendar is fixed, but back then it could have fallen out on different days. That's Shavuos, that's when we have the Yom Tov Shavuos, that's when we bring the carbon of the Shtei Lechem, and so on. So this is the cycle. You start with Pesach, you bring the Omer on the second day of Pesach, you count Sfiras HaOmer for 49 or 50 days, 50th day is Shavuos, you bring the carbon of the Shtei Lechem, also a grain carbon. The Omer was barley, the Shtei Lechem was wheat, and then you celebrate Shavuos. Now, in the context of this sequence, the Torah writes the following pasuk: V'lechem v'koli v'charmel lo sochlu at etzma yom hazeh. You shall not eat lechem, koli, and karmel. Lechem is an easy one. Lechem is bread. Koli is roasted kernels. They used to use this as candy in the Talmud. They talk about giving the kids kloyos, the roasted kernels of wheat. Karmel, Art Girl translates as plump kernels. Chazal talk about rach and mole. It's soft and full. Different types of, not flour or bread, but different types of roasted wheat. You can't eat lechem, koli, and karmel. Ad etzma yom hazeh, until the second day of Pesach, the day of the Karban HaOmer. Ad haviyachem es karban elokechem, until you bring this carbon, the carbon that we call the Karban HaOmer. This prohibition of not eating lechem, koli, and karmel is what we know today as the kashrus, the controversial kashrus question of Yashan, or Chadash, as it was usually referred to in earlier Sfarim. Chadash means new, Yashan means old. They are, of course, inverse terms, and for our purposes, anything that is not Chadash is Yashan, anything that's not Yashan is Chadash. This is the great controversy today over whether we have a prohibition to eat Chadash, whether we are required to be stringent on Yashan. In terms of modern kashrus, this is probably one of the three or four most famous kashrus controversies, where different aksherim, different people have different policies. You have Gebrok, you have Kitnios, you have Chol Yisrael, and you have Yashan, are the big controversies. All of you are probably familiar with Yashan and Chadash to some extent, at least in the sense that it's a problematic chumrah that you have to have when you have certain guests. Some of you may know more about it. So I want to discuss today a little bit about what exactly this prohibition is, what its scope is, what the controversy is, and why most people are lenient. As far as I know, all the major kashrus agencies certify products that are not Yashan. Some of them will additionally, as an option, will certify some products as being Yashan. Some may not even bother. But obviously the default practice in America for Ashkenazim certainly is that we are not stringent about Yashan. Some people are. So we'll discuss today the background of this, the historical development of the custom, the halachic issues. We'll go through perhaps the half dozen of the major arguments for leniency. We'll try to get a little bit of a picture for what the issue is. Now, incidentally, I keep referring to the prohibition of Chadash. The Torah actually says lechem, kali, and caramel. You shall not eat. Some of those who count the Tariq mitzvahs, 613 mitzvahs, actually count them as three separate prohibitions. Rambam, the Sefer Achinuch. The first big one is don't eat lechem. That's where they put all the literature. But then there are actually two more. One is for lechem. One little one for kali. Another one for caramel. Three prohibitions. Now, in practice, you know, there is some technical literature about what exactly is kali, what exactly is caramel. As a practical matter, we're not going to enter into that. As a practical matter, we treat the prohibition as a prohibition against consuming anything made of the, insofar as there is a prohibition, whenever the prohibition applies, it's a prohibition against consuming any food that has any of the chamesha seminim, the five grains, which we traditionally identify as wheat, barley, spelt, oats, and rye. Some controversy about that, but practically, for most people, it's going to be wheat, barley, and oats are going to be the big ones, mostly wheat. As we'll see, actually, historically, in some of the earlier generations, the big problem was actually barley. Today, I think, you know, barley's an issue too, but today, I think the big issue for most people is going to be wheat. Every loaf of bread, every cookie, every cracker, every bag of flour is mostly wheat, according to our American diet. Well, as we'll see, the big problem for earlier generations, either because of their diet or because of the growing seasons, actually had to do with barley. Those are the two big ones, wheat and barley. Today we have your Cheerios and other oat products. We have some spelt stuff too, and rye. But the prohibition, whatever lechem, kali, and caramel are, the prohibition is practically speaking, is against consuming any food, any product based on that contains some quantity of these five grains. So I just want to open by mentioning an interesting dispute between the Chassam Sofer. Actually, the Chassam Sofer is a revered teacher, Rabbi Nosson Adler, the legendary Kabbalist, Halachist, and innovative thinker in general from the late 18th century, and Rav Avadia Yosef. So the Chassam Sofer says that his great teacher, Rabbi Nosson Adler, used to say, we actually read Parshas Vayikra more than once during the year. We read it, Parshas Emor, and the end of Vayikra, we read it at least twice. We read it once now, next week, in this time of the year for Parshas Emor. We also read it, it is the reading of Sukkos, of the Yontem of Sukkos, we read it then. Rabbi Nosson Adler said that this aliyah falls out as Levi when you read it on Sukkos. A Levi, he said, who is not stringent about the prohibition of Chadash, should not be given this aliyah. It would be hypocrisy. It would be like a blatant. It would lack any sense of respect for someone who's not stringent about Chadash to read this aliyah, to get this aliyah, not acceptable. He said, how can it be? He's going to go read about Velechem, Bekali, Becharma, Lo Sochlo, Etzmayam Azeh. Then he's going to go home and drink his beer, which was made out of barley, and drink the hops or whatever they use, and eat his bread, which was flavored or which was the yeast perhaps was barley based. They use ingredients from barley, he says. Again, he doesn't mention wheat. Apparently, barley was the issue back then. He says that how can it be that someone will read to get this aliyah and then go home and do that? That's not acceptable, he says. You cannot get this aliyah. Now, as an aside, if I ask most of us, if we're talking about barley, what is the barley product that most of us probably use? For us, I think it would be chulim for most of us. Some people drink a lot of beer, I guess, but the thing that comes to mind for me, I'm not a beer drinker, would be chulim. The Rav Nosson Adler did not mention chulent. I don't know if he had a different chulent recipe that didn't involve barley, or if or beer was just more important and more on people's minds than chulent. But whatever it was, the examples he gives are the bread that was flavored with the barley ingredients, and the bread was probably wheat, but the wheat apparently wasn't an issue. But the issue was the barley and the beer, and how can it be? And he says he should not be given the aliyah of this parasha. Now, he doesn't say during Parshas Emor you shouldn't get the aliyah. And if you read his language carefully, it seems that what he means is that, as we'll discuss, based on the growing seasons, Chadash is not a problem this time of the year. As we'll discuss, the definition of Chadash is grain that grows, starts out, whenever grain grows, whenever it takes root, it starts out in a status of being prohibited. It flips to being permitted with the offering of the Karban Omer. So whenever the grain grows, whatever the 12 months of the year, as soon as it grows, it's usur. You have to wait until Pesach elapses. Now, in the time of the Beis HaMikdash, you had to actually bring the Karban HaOmer. Today, we do not have a Karban HaOmer, so today, you have to wait until the second day of Pesach elapses. Now, there's a dispute in the Gemara, whether it's the beginning of the second day of Pesach, Bizman HaZeh, the end of the second day of Pesach, Midaraisa, Midrabanan. Basically, it's a completely moot point. The only thing we eat that has grain on Pesach is matzah, and matzah meal, and matzah meal-based products. A person buys a box of matzahs, it's gonna, if it's a problem, it has to be okay for the first night of Pesach. You're not going to buy two sets of matzahs, one for the first day, one for the second day. But practically speaking, it's really a moot question whether it's the beginning of the second day, the end of the second day. The point is, in the time of the Mikdash, it was the Karban Homer, which was brought on the second day of Pesach. With Man Hazeh, you need the second day of Pesach itself without the Karban. So if the grain grows in Chanukah time in Kislev, so it's Usur from Kislev until Pesach. If the grain grows, is harvested around Tisha B'Av time in the summer, it's Usur for about 8 months until the next year. So the grain is Usur from when it grows, specifically from the Hashrasha, from when it takes root, whatever that point is, until the next Pesach. Now, obviously, and this is what we'll discuss later, there is a time has to elapse practically in the supply chain from when the grain grows until it makes it to the consumer's table. So grain that, let's say, would grow a month before Pesach, realistically, is not making it to your table until after Pesach, so such grain is never really going to be a problem. So right after Pesach, like right now, we're about 3 weeks after Pesach, there is no chadash around because no grain has grown in the last 3 weeks, and if it did, it's not making it to your table yet. So anything that grew before Pesach is fine because Pesach has elapsed. Anything that grew after Pesach is not on your table yet. So Rabbi Nachman Adler said, this time of the year, you read Parshas Emor, he seems to say, we don't care if someone who's not stringent about chadash gets us aliyah, because right now he's not doing anything wrong. And 6 months from now he'll be doing something wrong. Well, 6 months ago he did something wrong, or 2 months ago he did something wrong, maybe. But right now he's not engaged in any hypocritical conduct. So right now he seems to say he can get the aliyah of Parshas Emor. But when it gets to Sukkot time, and then already he says the chadash barley is starting to hit store shelves, and it's still true today to some extent. The chadash begins to become practically a problem around August, September for most products. So insofar as it is a problem, the problem begins around that time, the end of the summer, beginning of the fall, around circus time. That's when Rav Nosson Adler was worried. That's when he felt it would be hypocritical for someone to get this aliyah and go home and eat chadash. So he said that you should not give this aliyah to someone who is not stringent about chadash. Now,
maybe that's why he doesn't mention the chon. He wasn't talking about Shabbos, he was talking about Yom.
I was thinking of that, that maybe he meant it has to be actually the same day, so they went home and they drank beer, the chon was only on Shabbos, so if the second day of Sukkot didn't fall out on Shabbos, today you can't. Maybe, possible that's what he meant. Also, Rav Avadi Yosef, in passing, disagrees. Rav Avadi Yosef actually was very stringent about Chadosh, but in passing he disagrees. In the middle of a discussion of something else, he has a general tshuva about giving aliyahs to people who do certain averis. So he brings a Knesset Gdola of Chaim Ben Venisti, an earlier Sephardic authority from the 17th century. Rav Chaim Ben Venisti said, someone who is lax, who is a sinner with regard to arayas, to certain sexual transgressions, could or even should be given the laning of Achrimas, I guess, the laning of the arayas in the Torah. It's good for him. It's not hypocrisy, it's Musar. If he sees what the Torah says about how terrible these averis are, maybe he'll see, maybe I better shape up. So we could give him this aliyah. Go ahead, he says. Says Rav Avadi Yosef, give the person who eats chadash this aliyah. Maybe he'll see. The Torah says, V'lechem v'koli v'charma lo sochlo, I'll stop eating chadash. So on the one hand, or nothing, Adler felt it would be hypocritical, or Rav Avadi feels maybe it'll be good Musar for him. But we'll come back to this a little bit later. After we understand what the level of mandatoriness the chadash is, we'll return to these tshuvas. So as I said, we know that most people today are in the United States, Ashkenazim in the United States are not that stringent about it. Sfardim tend to be more stringent for reasons that we'll discuss. Will become a little clearer as we go. There are, as I said, about a half dozen major reasons, and actually combinations of these half dozen reasons that the poskim have tried to offer to justify the prevailing custom, which goes back many centuries, to be lenient on chadash. On the other hand, many achronim have acknowledged that most of the heterim traditionally offered are not so satisfying. They rely on shitas that are not necessarily the halacha, on dubious ideas, on things that are not the simple reading of the Gemara. And so, in other words, aside from the half dozen or so halachic arguments they make, there is one meta-halachic point which underlies the whole discussion of chadash. That is the notion that they were desperate. Many Rishonim and Achronim testify that it was very, very difficult, bordering on impossible, for Jews to be in Europe to be stringent about Chadash. They often weren't farmers. They didn't have their own grain. They were dependent on imports from the non-Jews. They typically didn't have a lot of visibility into the supply chain. They often didn't know what was chadash and what was not. If you required stringency, you would basically cut off, you know, bread as the staff of life. You'd basically be cutting off grain as a food source. This was considered very, very difficult. As a matter of fact, I mentioned the beer. In many of the tshuvos seem to imply that beer was the big problem. We treat beer as a luxury, as an indulgence, as some people think beer is still essential today. But as you see from many areas in halacha, in earlier generations, beer was considered a staple. Apparently, that was largely because water was not potable. Water was infested. It was buggy. It was impure. The only really appropriate source of drink was wine, beer. One of the Chuvas, as a matter of fact, says that he wants to be machmer. He says, you know, some of the earlier sources that were lenient because they were desperate, they had no choice. That was because beer was the staple drink. In other countries where wine is the staple drink, you know, beer is not so important, so you don't have to be so lenient.
I can testify that in the Ukraine, even today, beer is like the way we drink water.
Right. So that's what Slav was saying. But that's this kind of cultural tradition has survived. The water is not the drink that people drank. People drank beer for whatever the reason. It was considered so difficult to go without beer or something, some beverage like that. Whatever the exact cultural reasons for it were, that was considered impossible. So as you see from many of the sources, that was one of the main reasons why they looked for leniencies. And of course, that creates one of the main impetuses for stringency today. Today we are, outside of the Ukraine, we are much less desperate than they used to be. We have so much more money, we have so much more resources, we have so much more variety, we have so many more options, and certainly in the first world country like the United States, we are much less desperate than they used to be. It is not that difficult to be stringent about chadash. It requires planning, it requires not eating at kiddushes, it requires picking and choosing and giving up certain brands that you might like. And it's not trivial, but it's certainly, I think it's fair to say, it is nowhere near the level of desperation that they had in Europe. So that's one of the, as we'll see, that's one of the main reasons for stringency today, that whatever the heterim will see are, they were based on difficulty. It's much less difficult. That's kind of one of the main arguments for Chumrah. But now let's go through, let's discuss some of the actual heterim, some of the actual arguments given by the post. As we mentioned, the tradition to be lenient is not a new one. It goes back centuries. And for the last 200 years or so, many posts can testify to broadly speaking, there are major exceptions, but broadly speaking, there is a kind of divergence between the Hasidic traditions and the Lithuanian yeshiva tradition. Hasidim are more lenient for reasons that we'll discuss. It goes back even to the Baal Shem Tov, who apparently made some pronouncement about the legitimacy of leniency on Chadash. The Litvish yeshivish tradition is more stringent, although by no means wholly stringent. Most yeshiva students still in the United States, probably up to the present time, are not stringent. And we'll discuss again what the reasons are. But again, in terms of the serious literature, we have a little bit in the medieval period, and then begins, so probably that we have about 800 years of largely Ashkenazic authorities, Germany, Poland, Russia, arguing for leniency, and we'll see what some of these arguments are. Not to go strictly in chronological order, I want to start with a Bach. The Bach is Rabbi Yoel Sirkis, writing about circa 1600, about 400 years ago. The Bach felt that we should justify the consumption of chadash on the grounds that grain that is grown, that is owned by non-Jews, is not subject to the prohibition of chadash. Now, the actual sources the Bach has, the arguments, as well as the arguments from many of the opinions we're going to discuss, are extremely technical. There are numerous discussions in the Talmud about Chadash, which discuss many of these questions, and the argument, the Talmud is intricate. There are many questions about, the main questions have to do with which shitas are authoritative, are normative, which ones do the halacha follow. We're not going to go through the Talmudic texts, we're not going to go through the various arguments they bring for or against the various opinions, but the Bach, one of the main heterim is the Bach. The Bach wrote that he thinks that there's a solid, legitimate heter in that grain grown by non-Jews is not subject to the prohibition of chadash. Now, of course, that means if that's the heter, you obviously have to be much more stringent about grain that is grown by Jews. And even in Europe, where the Jews were not primarily an agrarian society. There were Jews who had farms. There were Jews who cultivated grain. And there are questions about rent, if the Jew rented from the non-Jew. But there are actually tshuvos that say that insofar as your heter is going to be that tshuva of a non-Jew is not subject to the prohibition of chadash, obviously there's a major exception that doesn't apply to tshuva grown by a Jew. And even more significantly, today in modern Israel, where the farms are owned by Jews, many of them, probably most of them, then that's not a heter. And in general, we should point out, most of the heterim discussed by the poskim, as we'll see, for various reasons, including obviously this Bach, do not apply in Eretz Yisrael. The leniencies are primarily in Chutz Laaretz. Most of the leniencies are based on svaras that apply in Chutz Laaretz, and certainly this Bach is a classic example. In Chutz Laaretz, we have a basis for leniency, or in general, tvua that's owned by non-Jews. We can be lenient. That was the opinion of the Bach. Many others strongly disagreed with the Bach. They felt his arguments were not persuasive. Again, we're not going to go into the technical Talmudic analysis of which passages in the Talmud support the Bach, which tend to argue against the Bach. But suffice it to say, the Bach's own son-in-law, the Taz, as well as the Vilna Gaon and others, strongly Shach, you know, many poskim strongly disagreed with the Bach. I'm not sure about the Shach, but the others, the Taz, the Gaon, strongly disagreed with the Bach, and you know, many felt the Bach is not a sufficient heter to rely on. Now, I saw a remarkable tshuva in the Avnei Nezer. Avnei Nezer of Sachachov, about a century ago. He was a chassid, a European chassid. He has a tshuva that actually is not primarily about chadash. The primary question was about another interesting sort of kashrus controversy. It was about estrogim. It had to do with the legitimacy of using an estrog from the Greek isle of Corfu. The estrogim of Corfu, again, were an old debate going back again to the time of the Bach, going back a good four centuries. The question had to do with the purity of their ancestry. We know that one of the big bugaboos of estrog is that they need to be purebred, they can't be grafted, according to most opinions. The estrogim of Corfu were suspect for centuries of having been grafted with lemons. So this is an old debate going back again to the time of the Bach or earlier about whether the estrogim of Corfu are acceptable or not. And Achronim came down on both sides. So the Avnei Nezer was asked about may one use an estrog of Corfu. So he says that the Hasidim in Poland use estrogim of Corfu. And the reason is, he says, is because the Rebbe of Lublin, not sure which Rebbe he's talking about, maybe the Chazi of Lublin, I don't know, but the Rebbe of Lublin, he says, was a big fan of estrogim of Corfu, and they follow his lead. Says the Avnei Nezer, so what does that mean? What does that signify? The Rebbe liked these estrogim. So he says, well, maybe it means that the Rebbe, with his Ruach HaKodesh, he knew that these were authentic estrogim, and the Hasidim rely on that. That's fine, he says. The problem is, he says, I don't know if that's really what the Rebbe meant when he said that estrogim are okay. He says, because, I'll give you another example, he says. The Hasidim in Poland eat Chadash, he says, and the reason they do that is because the Rebbe said, the Rebbe used to serve Chadash at his tish, at his home, the Rebbe served Chadash. Now, why did the Rebbe do that, he says? Because the Rebbe used to say that he was a descendant of the Bach, and since his grandfather, his illustrious predecessor, the Bach, said that Chadash and Chutzla, that Chadash of a non-Jew is okay, the Rebbe says, I follow the opinion of my grandfather. That's nice, Avnezer says. He's a Talmud, he's a descendant, whatever it is. He can follow his grandfather's opinion. But for us, for those who are not particular devotees of the Rebbe of Lublin and his illustrious predecessor, the Bach, for us it's Machlok Zaposkim, and he says, maybe in Chadash, maybe you can rely on that, he says. When it comes to Estrogim, here too, he says, the Rebbe of Lublin was just relying on the Bach, and we know he doesn't discuss Chadash, but at least with regard to Estrogim, he says, the Bach is not the normally accepted opinion, and therefore the Rebbe is not adding anything to the mix. He's just telling you that he follows the Bach, but we don't follow the Bach, so we're in trouble. So the Avnei Nezer is telling us that the reason the Hasidim in Poland used to eat Chadash is because that's what the Rebbe of Lublin did, and the Rebbe of Lublin did this because that's what the Bach did. So the Minig in Poland, he says, goes back to the Bach. So it's not entirely clear whether he's being supportive of the Minig or not. He's saying they do it because that's their particular tradition, going back to the Bach. Those of us who are not descendants of the Bach, who are not considered Talmidim of the Bach, should we rely on this Bach or not? It's hard to know. But he does note that the Minig was that the Hasidim in Poland used to, the Chassidim in Poland used to be lenient on Chadash, and as I said, there is a general sense you get in the poskim that the Chassidim used to be lenient, whether because of the Bach or for the Baal Shem Tov or for other reasons. Chassidim have generally been lenient. And there are major exceptions. The Shulchan Aruch Rav, Rav Shneur Zalman of Liadi, the founder of Chabad Chassidus, his sefer is, you know, gospel, so to speak, for Chabad Chassidim. He is actually stringent. He brings the various heterim of the Bach and others that we'll discuss. He says that the heterim are not really not really solid heterim. He says at the very least the Baal Nefesh should be stringent. He says, and he really does not approve of. I don't remember his language, whether he says Mikra Din, you have to be Machmer, or whether he strongly encourages being Machmer, but he strongly urges that the Haterim don't really cut it. He says, at the end of the day, the Kash is better than the answers. Chadash is a mitzvah. It applies to us, he says, and a person really should be stringent. Now, I don't actually know contemporary Chabad practice, whether they are stringent or not, but the Shulchan Aruch HaRav and one or two others of the leading Chabad poskim historically were somewhat stringent on the idea of Chadash. Now, even before the Bach, the truth is, probably the earliest heter given by the poskim goes back to the Arzurua. The Arzurua was a German medieval authority, Rav Yitzchak of Vienna. He discusses the question of Chadash. He articulates front and center that we need to try, that the heter is based on the fact that we have no choice, he says. We have to buy grain. He uses bread also. We have to buy bread from the non-Jews. That's where we get our grain products from, he says. It would be difficult or impossible to be stringent, he says. So what's the heter? So he raises one of the most fundamental issues, which is the prohibition of Chadash, the Bach discusses, tvuah owned by a non-Jew? Let's forget non-Jew. Let's say even tvuah owned by a Jew. Does Chadash apply at all in Chutz Lartz? Now, we know that many of the, what we call mitzvahs tluyas baretz, many of the commandments related to agriculture, truma, shmita, these types of things, do not apply in Chutz Lartz. We worry about the clementines from Israel, we don't worry about fruit from the U.S., Truma, we don't take truma, fruits from the U.S. Many of what we call mitzvahs tluyas baretz are exclusive to Eretz Yisrael. So the question is, what about Chadash? Is the prohibition of Chadash, does it apply only in Eretz Yisrael or even in Chutz Lartz? Now the language of the biblical text is, Chukas olam l'doroseichem b'chol moshvaseichem. It is an eternal decree for your generation in all your dwelling places. Sounds pretty clear, b'chol moshvaseichem. It applies anywhere, even in Chutz Lartz. And that is really the normative opinion. If you look in Shulchan Aruch, Chadash is discussed in two different places in Shulchan Aruch. It's discussed in Aruch Chaim and Hilchos Pesach, Hilchos Shavuos, the end of Hilchos Pesach. It's discussed again in Yeridaya. In both places, the Shulchan Aruch is quite clear, and the Ramah does not disagree. Shulchan Aruch says in Hilchos Pesach, Asur lechol Chadash af bezman hazeh. Chadash is prohibited even in contemporary times. Bein lechem, bein kali, bein karmel, etc. It is prohibited everywhere. In Eretz Yisrael until the date, but it applies in Chutz Lartz too. In Yeridaya, the Shulchan Aruch says, Asur lechol Chadash mitfuas chameshas minim ad shiyakrav haomer. Today we have no omer. It's asur for the entire Tazayin. Isur Chadash noeg bein baaretz, bein b'chutz Lartz, bein b'shel Yisrael, bein b'shel goyim. The prohibition applies to everyone. It applies in Chutz Lartz. It applies to non-Jews, not like the Bach. It applies in Chutz Lartz, not like this Arzurua we're going to discuss. And the Ramah does not disagree. The Ramah does not challenge the Machaber on these basic assumptions. We Ashkenazim typically follow the Ramah. The Ramah does not disagree. Chadash applies in Chutz Lartz. Chadash applies bizman hazeh. The Arzurua, however, suggested that Chadash does not apply in Chutz Lartz. Again, he goes through a very intricate analysis of the Talmudic sources. Now, he knows the Talmud itself brings explicit debate about this. There are some opinions that it does, some opinions that it doesn't. Some of the major Rishonim, the Rif, the early Rishonim, Paskin L'chumra, that it does apply even in Chutz Lartz. The Arzurua said, because it is a great Shasat Chak, because it is difficult to be stringent, and there are some opinions that it does not apply, we have the right, based on meta-halachic arguments, we have the right to say that the Shasat Chak, we're going to be so mech on the opinions, we'll rely on the opinions that Chadash does not apply in Chutz Lartz. This is basically the heter of the Arzurua, that Chadash does not apply in Chutz Lartz. Taz argues for this also. And again, this is the second heter, similar to the Bach. The Bach says it does not apply to grain owned by non-Jews. Bar Zerua, the Taz, other Akronim say it does not apply to any grain in Chutz Laretz. So again, same type of heter as the Bach. The problem with these opinions are that these are not really the mainstream opinions. B'shas v'chach, maybe you can rely on it, but other posts can say it's not la'alacha. The halacha is the Shulchan Aruch doesn't paskin. Shulchan Aruch doesn't pass like this opinion, and it's not really the mainstream opinion. That's the obvious problem with these opinions. Now, the Ramah, although I mentioned the Ramah does agree to the Shulchan Aruch that Chadash applies in Chutz Laretz and Chadash applies to grain of a non-Jew, the Ramah does nevertheless try to find some rationale, some justification for what he acknowledges was the Ashkenazic custom not to be stringent about Chadash. The Ramah points out a couple of things. The Ramah says that Stam Tvua, that again, you have no visibility into the supply chain, so you don't know whether the Tvua is Chadash or not. The Ramah says it is permitted because of Svek Svek. This is a celebrated Ramah, a celebrated application of a celebrated halachic principle. Halacha has a principle called Svek Sveka. The halacha is that when you have one doubt, one suffix, when a question is biblical, you have to be stringent. Rabbinic, you can be lenient, but when you have a single doubt about a question which is biblical, a question that is biblical, you have to be stringent. When you have two doubts, then you can be lenient. It's a Svek Sveka. Maybe this is mutter because of this reason, maybe it's not. Even if it's osir, but if I have in parallel a separate reason, which independently is enough for a reason to be lenient, I can say maybe this reason is, maybe this allows it. On a very kind of simple level, you're kind of multiplying probabilities. If each one is 50%, then the chance of at least one of them being in your favor is 25%. That's just kind of a way of looking at it that's not really accurate. The halacha does not really work by actual percentiles. You can have a... You can have a Svek Sveka, which is, you know, not all the Svekas have to be exactly equal. You can have cases which are still, you know, fairly close to 50, but if there are two Svekas, it can be a total of maybe 60%. Will still be mutter. You can have a single suffix, which might be 75%, which might in some cases be usher. Halacha cannot be reduced, you know, just like law, halacha can't be reduced to a pure mathematical calculation. But that's just a way, a kind of mushel we can give. That Svek Sveka, if we have two independent Svekas and either one is enough to argue for leniency, then we can be Mekel. What is the Svek Svek over here? So the Ramah says, when we have grain, and again, we have no visibility into the supply chain, we don't know what this grain is, maybe this is last year's grain, it's 18 months old, even if it's this year's grain from the current year's crop, maybe it was harvested early enough, before it was grown, Hashrasha, early enough, before Pesach, so even if it's only 3 months old, let's say you're talking about circus time, it might have to be 7 months old, maybe the grain already took root this year, but before Pesach. That's called a Svek Sveka, according to the Ramah. Many poskim strongly reject this. Rabbi Kiveger brings from other Achronim, this is not a Svek Sveka, this is the same Suffolk. There is one Suffolk here. Did it grow before the Omer, did it grow after the Omer? You can't break each day of the year and make 300 Svekas. Maybe it grew on Tuesday, maybe it grew on Monday, maybe it grew last Tuesday. Those are not separate Svekas. There is halakhically speaking, one Suffolk here. Did it grow before the Omer? Did it grow after the Omer? That you can break it up into last year or this year, maybe three Svekas, maybe 2 years ago, maybe 3 years ago. Those are not individual Svekas. Those are all one big Suffolk. And therefore, again, we don't count strict probability. The fact that that the passage of time, there might be 10 years of pre-Pesach Tvua and only 1 year of Pesach Tvua, that would be called a Rove. That actually is a related heter. Some posts can actually argue that Rove of the Tvua in their circumstances came from before the Omer. So one way or another, some posts can play with the idea of Svek Sveka, some posts can play with the idea of Rove. We're not going to get too deeply into the mechanics of whether it is or is not a valid Svek Sveka. Some very subtle and very tricky analysis by the Achronim. Rove is an easier thing to understand. We have to make some kind of evaluation of Rove grain on the marketplace. Is Rove grain coming from before the Omer or after the Omer? So these points are debated by the poskim. This is really, we can call this a third major heter, a third or fourth major heter. The idea that that even if we accept that Chadash and Chutz Laretz is, and even a Chadash of a non-Jew is Aser and Aser Midaraisa, since we don't generally know about any specific product that this is or is not Chadash, we can rely on one Safek, on two Svekas, on Svek Sveka, on Rove. We can rely on various types of arguments to say we don't know when we have enough Svekas and enough Tzedadim, enough probabilities to be lenient and say this may not be Chadash and Torah allows you to rely on it. Now, This is true as far as it goes. The post can point at, I mean, if you work out the details, the post can accept that certainly the heter of Rove. If Rove Tvua is, if Rove Tvua comes from non-Chadash, that might be okay. The problem is, sometimes you do know that, the Achronim again, sometimes there were Jewish farmers who knew exactly what they had, that they knew the Tvua was this year's, and sometimes it's easy to find out. This actually becomes a very important question today. So some people have argued because we have much more access to the supply chain, we have the internet, we have a much more regular system of communication, of information sharing, it's much easier to find out on some products whether they are or are not Chadash, and maybe you do have to find out. They actually publish a guide to Chadash, which actually has information on many products that tells you that this might be, this is not Chadash. They do try to find out by consulting with stores, by consulting with kashrus agencies. We can find out much more than we used to be able to, and that is actually so that's kind of a double-edged sword. On the one hand, those who want to be stringent, it helps figure out what is Chadash and what is not Chadash. Every year they update it with new information. On the other hand, it actually creates additional stringency because you may not be able to rely as much on Sveikas and Rose when the information is sitting there in front of you. You can download it right off the internet for free. Download the guidebook about what is Chadash and what is not. So I've heard at least one major posek, I'm not sure if he was being serious or in jest, actually was a little bit unhappy with the guide. He said the guide actually creates more of a problem for us. We don't want to be stringent because now the information is sitting and tapping us on the shoulder. Now maybe we have less of a basis for leniency if we rely on these types of suffolk and rove. Now, we should mention also, these are probably the three most widely discussed considerations and combinations of these. Like, if you say it's not Daraisa, and anyway it might not be so stringent, and it's a Safek, whether it is Chadash or is not. And moreover, even if Chadash is not, like the Arzurua says, even if Chadash does not apply in Chutz La'aretz, that means Midaraisa doesn't apply in Chutz La'aretz. What about Midrabanan? Is there still a rabbinic prohibition of Chadash in Chutz La'aretz? Some posts can say there is. It might not be biblical, it might be rabbinic. So what have we really gained if it still applies on a rabbinic level? So first of all, anything rabbinic is less stringent. And if we have sfeikus, we have much more basis for leniency. Once it's a safek rabbanon, obviously halacha allows us to be much more lenient. Moreover, there are opinions, again, we've shown them going back to the medieval period, there are opinions who ruled that if it is rabbinic, it does not apply everywhere in Chutz La'aretz, it only applies in certain areas near Eretz Yisrael. This is an idea we find in various Rishonim regarding certain other mitzvahs tluyas ba'aretz, certain other of the commandments that applied truma, according to some opinions, they did make certain gzeiros outside Eretz Yisrael, but not in America, only in certain areas in the Middle East, around Eretz Yisrael, certain countries, they had gzeiros of truma. So there are shitas, the Baruch Shama, the Sefer Truma. There are some opinions that even if the rabbis did prohibit Chadash, even outside Eretz Yisrael, they only did so in areas near Eretz Yisrael, not in America, not in Europe. Now, if you say that Chadash is Asur Midaraisa in Chutz La'aretz, then there's no distinction. It's Asur everywhere. If Chadash is only Asur Midrabanan, then we have two bases for leniency. First, anything that's rabbinic allows more room for sfeikas and other doubts and other bases for leniency. And B, if it's only Midrabanan, they might not have been gozer in Chutz La'aretz, far away from Eretz Yisrael. So, let's go back a little bit now to that Chasam Sofer we mentioned earlier. Rav Nosson Adler said that someone who is lenient about Chadash should not be given the Aliyah around circus time where Chadash is already hitting the store shelves, should not be given the Aliyah of Chadash. Now, the Chasam Sofer actually gives one other example of this, one other application of this type of idea. He says, this year, he says, last year for us, this year when he was writing the Tshuva, he says, is the year of Shemitah. We know there is a halacha of Shemitah's Ksafim. Debts are canceled in Shemitah. Now, again, here also, very similar to Chadash, there was a long-standing tradition among Ashkenazim of ignoring the halacha of Shemitah. Now, I don't mean writing a prosbul. Prosbul we do today. Shul did it here. Other shuls do it. Writing a prosbul is a perfectly acceptable, it goes back to the Talmud, sanctioned technique. But many communities in Ashkenaz, going back again to the medieval period, 800 years or so, did not even bother with a prosbul. They just simply ignored Shemitah entirely. And beginning with the rush, there was a lot of grappling with this. How can we do this? It's a halacha. You know, the Shemitah, according to most poskim, Shemitah's karka, the agricultural Shemitah, is only in Eretz Yisrael. But Shemitah's ksafim, the forgiveness of debts, according to most poskim, applies in Chutz La'aretz too. So what on earth are the Ashkenazim doing by ignoring Shemitah, very similar to Chadash? So once again, all kinds of rationales and justifications have been proposed. None of them are all that satisfactory. So the Chasam Sofer says, just like my Rebbe, Rabbi Nosson Adler, said, someone who doesn't keep Chadash should not be given the aliyah of Chadash. So too, someone who does not write Prosbols, who ignores the halacha of Shemitah, should not be given the aliyah of Shemitah's Ksafim. Now, it's certainly possible to understand, based on the analogy to Shemitah's Ksafim, many poskim have held that even though it's a difficult minhag to justify, it is a legitimate Ashkenazic minhag. Moshe Feinstein, for example, had a tshuva about someone who forgot or didn't write a Prosbol. Is he allowed to collect his debt after Shemitah? Moshe Feinstein says yes. It is established Ashkenazic custom to ignore Shemitah. We may not fully understand the reason, but it's a hallowed tradition. It's a minhag. It becomes the halacha. Even if we don't fully understand why, we write a principle. He says, L'chumra, we try to be machmer. Yarei Shemayim, Bal Nefesh, you should try to be machmer. But you don't strictly have to. So the Chasam Sofer may have understood the same thing was true for Shemitah. That ideally, because on paper it's a difficult minhag to reconcile, you should write a prosbul, and it's not really right to not write a prosbul, even though it's a legitimate minhag, it's a chumrah, and therefore you shouldn't get the aliyah, even if you're in defiance of this chumrah. And similarly, he may have understood Chadash the same way, that yes, there is an Ashkenazic custom to ignore Chadash. We don't really have a single good reason why, but all right, so you shouldn't get the aliyah, even though you're not really an Avaryan. Or the Chasam Sofer may have felt that you are actually an Avaryan. I don't know what we know of his personal conduct about Chadash. He does write in the Shuva that the reason it's such a difficult minhag, he says, is because according to Rav Poskim, Chadash is Aser Midaraisa. Incidentally, I should take this opportunity to mention that the phrase Chadash Aser Minatara, Chadash is biblically prohibited, is a famous slogan, a famous kind of aphorism of the Chasam Sofer himself. In the original context, Chadash Aser Minatara means that grain that grew is biblically prohibited until Pesach, until the offering of the Karban Omer. The Chasam Sofer, in a kind of literary flourish, used the phrase metaphorically in his great battle against the Reform to mean Chadash, any innovation, any variation on time-honored Jewish practice is Aser Minatara. Now, you know, there's been a lot of fighting about this, and the Chasam Sofer was not nearly as hidebound as this might make him sound. The Chasam Sofer was not such a fanatic. Some of his students were much more stringent, much more vehement than he was. And he himself was certainly a tireless crusader against reform. But the Chasam Sofer had this slogan. He used to say, Chadash Aser Minatara. So again, the Chasam Sofer does say in this tshuva here that even literal Chadash, he does say, according to most Rishonim, it is Aser Minatara. Whether he himself felt you're actually an Avaryan for not doing it, or he just felt that since the minhag is so hard to justify, there's a strong imperative l'chatchila, a person should be stringent, and therefore at the very least, you know, have the decency not to get this aliyah if you aren't going to choose stringency. Many Achronim take this kind of intermediate position, like the Shulchan Aruch Harav, like the Chasam Sofer, that it's really a difficult minhag to justify. It might be acceptable, but the mice of the poskim allowed it, the minhag was to do it, but it is a very difficult minhag to justify. Mishnah Berurah, for example, if you read the Mishnah Berurah in Hilchos Pesach, so he writes, he goes through some of the various heterim we've been discussing, and some of them only apply to non-Jews, he says. Jews have to be more stringent. Israel certainly have to be more stringent. So he writes, he says, Ein b'yadeinu limchos b'yadam ekilim. We don't have the power to object, to protest against those who are adopting the traditional attitude of leniency. Mikol makom, kol bal nefesh, those who are pious, those who are moved to obey the Torah to the best of their abilities. Lo yis makal ha-terem alalu, a person should not rely on these types of leniencies. V'yachmer la'atma b'chol ma'ashefer, be machmer for yourself. This is one of the great questions, of course. If somebody wants to be machmer, should he impose this on his parents? Should he impose this on his host if he goes somewhere for Shabbos? And what does it mean to be machmer la'atma? Because again, the Harbig Dali Rishonim said this was Araisa, so the Mishnah Berurah takes what I think is a very mainstream attitude among the poskim. Mikra din, you can be lenient. It's certainly Bal Nefesh Yachmer, it is a nice idea, it's a good idea to be stringent. That's the position of the Mishnah Berurah as well as many others. I saw Rabbi Chaim, Rabbi Howard Jachter, says, again, that even some Litvish were makel. He says that Rav Moshe Feinstein, he heard from a student of his, used to be lenient, and he used to eat the yeshiva's food, MTJ, which was lenient about Chadash. He quotes Rav Soloveitchik as saying that Rav Soloveitchik personally was not machmer. So even great Litvish authorities were not machmer. Again, it's always hard to bring raya from half a century ago where it was much more difficult. Today we have the guy. Today we have more Hechsherim that give Hechsherim on Yashan. So there is, again, more basis today for being lenient than there, for being stringent than there used to be. It's both easier, and because information is there, it is not as easy to find the justifications that they did. Nevertheless, it's a venerable, time-honored practice. You know, for 800 years or so, the Ashkenazim were historically lenient. Again, largely, apparently, out of desperation, also because they had this whole series of justifications. Once again, as I mentioned, this does not real. Most of these svaras do not apply in Eretz Yisrael. I mean, obviously, the Svek Svaker question, if you assume that some posts have said that depending on the agricultural culture, depending on when the planting seasons were and all that, there were going to be certain products that might have been generally chadash in generally yashan in Eretz Yisrael, and obviously those we could be lenient on. But in general, in Eretz Yisrael, there is much less basis for leniency in terms of the halachic questions because you're in Eretz Yisrael and it's grain that belongs to Eretz Yisrael. And in general, Sfardim are much more stringent than Ashkenazim because, as we said, historically, the culture of leniency is exclusively an Ashkenazic one, going back to the Arzarua in Vienna, the Bach in Poland, the Avinezer, the actual tradition, the historic tradition of being lenient, almost all the major sources, almost all those who discuss it, were all Ashkenazim. They were both discussing Ashkenazic practice, and they were Ashkenazic authorities. The Shulchan Aruch himself brings no leniency whatsoever. So Sfardim tend to be much more stringent than Ashkenazim. Not all Sfardim. Here in Silver Spring, I know, you know, some distinguished Sfardim are stringent, some are not, but in general, this is one of the areas where the Sfardim are much more stringent than the Ashkenazim. A friend of mine told me he once heard, I think recorded, a share from Rav Avadia. Rav Avadia Yosef, in general, is not a posek who looks for stringencies. He's not a posek who's out to find chumras. So the idea of Svek Sveker was a big one with him. He was very quick to find leniencies. But in this issue, I have heard that he actually was quite strict. And according to my friend, someone asked him in a live share, Rav Omer, that in Chadash is Asur Minat Torah, that's in Eretz Yisrael. What about Chutz La'aretz? So Rav Avadia stops and says, Mali Chazir, Mali Chadash. Chazir is Asur, Chadash is Asur. You wouldn't eat swine's flesh, you shouldn't eat Chadash. Now, obviously, Rav Avadia is perfectly well aware that there is a long tradition of leniency in Chutz La'aretz, but I guess he was making a point. You shouldn't treat Chadash as a Chumrah. It's a biblical verse. V'lechem v'koli v'charmer lo socho. That's my yom hazeh. But at the end of the day, we end up with the Mishnah Berurah, with the Shulchan Aruch Harav. I think it's fair to say that it is something that Bal Nefesh could be machmer on. If you ask individual Rabbanim, you'll get, I think, very somewhat different opinions about whether it is a desirable Chumrah for someone to adopt here in 21st century America.